Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 84, section 5, which is old single column, page 936. All right. Let's keep pushing forward. You can tell by the title of this section that we're doing just exactly that. We're pushing forward from the preceding section, woman's status in early society. And so, well, let's advance things a little bit. You know, you have. For instance, those developmental epics, you know, that you might think of when they say something like developing mores. You know, just in general, stepping forward, bringing in more genuine personal nature. At first, sort of the heights of unconscious. Personal influence on the system, and then more and more consciously, you're pushing from tribes to nations, you know, in that sequence of clans to tribes to nations. You might be looking for signs of early statehood concepts being in play. So you know that's the basics of what we're stepping into, but the specific issue that I've been hinting at for a little while is, you know, this is the section when they finally bring it to, you know, the main point that they want to deliver to the women of the world, you know, we'll see that, you know, here in a little bit. I'll just leave it at that. You know, it very much brings why the revelation is here. You know, that fundamentally, it's not in. We don't have issues with individuals. We have an issue with our collective expression as a civilization, and we've been, you know, studying this block of three papers about marriage and family, and remember from the very first things they told us is that that all gets started because of the different way that women are minded from men, that they're the key foundational element. It starts with just females themselves, and then their maternal instinct and their children, and then bringing men into play with that, and eventually you have the family and the home, and you have the building block of civilization. So obviously, if there's an emergency, it's not some, you know, secondary or tertiary or whatever issue. It's some very primary foundational issue that is in jeopardy. So they're going to finally come to that exclamation point here. All right, so let's see what they have to say for us here.
Section 5, Women Under the Developing Mores. In self-perpetuation, woman is man's equal. But in the partnership of self-maintenance, she labors at a decided disadvantage. This handicap of enforced maternity can only be compensated by the enlightened mores of advancing civilization and by man's increasing sense of acquired fairness.
All right, so acquired fairness. Obviously nothing natural there. That men are going to be drawing upon. They're going to be challenged by society to find more refined sensibilities than they have naturally, because naturally they need to be fairly coarsely constructed, because you got to be instinctual about just sort of throwing yourself headlong into, you know, either defense or war against the elements and the hordes. So, you know, there, you know, we'll see if they bring that up again, that whole issue of, you know, getting to fairness, and not just the more basic issues. And so here again, you know, they're reminding us of what should be obvious. Anyone who's not totally self-blinded, that, you know, the just the basic physical difference, and then, of course, the the maternal instinct, as they're pointing out there, the enforced maternity, it puts women at a decided disadvantage in the self-maintenance issue. You know, and you can go back and think about when they talked about the institutions of self-maintenance, the institutions of self-perpetuation, institution of self-gratification, you know, what specifically you should have in mind about that decided disadvantage. You know, just, you know, the way they start out with the institutions of self-maintenance, these institutions embrace those practices growing out of food hunger and its associated instincts of self-preservation. So just, you know, reflecting on that little element, and we've mentioned them a few times already. You know, when it comes to even something as simple as feeding oneself, when you have, you know, to be keeping a very close eye on a baby, right? That can be complicated. You know, to just try to catch a rabbit while you're, you know, dragging a baby around, you know, and good luck trying to bring down a mammoth. Okay. All right, so, you know, just that simple fact is complicated by maternity issues. And then we've mentioned the self-preservation. You know, that's always a problem. You know, we see it in just about every movie where you have hordes descending on a village. Right? The mothers, you know, bend down to shield their child, and then the guy riding with a battle axe on a horse just takes them out, you know. So, yeah, that's the sort of basic coarse stuff that they're, you know, they're talking about there, and that's just inescapable. That men and women need to work together to overcome those issues. Yeah, and that's what they mean by compensated by the enlightened mores of advancing civilization. You know, there has to be a system of men and women. Or, you know, one or the other is incomplete. Now, despite the fact that there is, like they mentioned, okay, there's a basic genetic contribution equality, and there's that spiritual equality that we've talked about. You know, okay, so all that, yes, but what about all the inequality? And how do you overcome that? You overcome that by establishing an equitable system with men and women. All right, what else do they say?
As society evolved, the sex standards rose higher among women because they suffered more from the consequences of the transgression of the sex mores. Man's sex standards are only tardily improving as a result of the sheer sense of that fairness which civilization demands. Nature knows nothing of fairness. Makes woman alone suffer the pangs of childbirth.
Yeah, so there's fairness again. You know, they're trying to obviously stress what I said right up front. Yeah, it's not natural. Right? Nature knows nothing of fairness. So again, you know, the irony of people clamoring for everything to be ever more natural, and it's and in the next breath clamoring that things aren't fair. It's like, well, okay, there's a problem there. Okay, which do you want? again, just that. That fact, like they're stressing. You can almost already see that they're kind of focusing their words more directly at women than at men. You know, it's definitely moving in that direction. You know, they're saying to women, "Yes, you're going to feel a strong tinge of unfairness about this, okay? But you have to just face the fact that you are what you are. There's no changing that. And, adopt some sort of very, sort of eventually self-destructive ideology because of it is ridiculous. At the very least, if not self-destructive, self-loathing, or a lot of times it gets flipped around, other hating. This is all your fault that I'm, by nature this way. It's like, wait a minute, no, it's by nature you're that way. It has nothing to do, men didn't make women that way. If you want to blame someone, blame God, right? God made us different. And then throwing that whole bit, man sex standards are only tardily improving as a result of the sheer sense of that fairness which civilization demands. So again, saying the fairness, see how they're trying to remind you that when you actually get to that first sense of things needing to be mutual, right? I mean, that's the key thing, remember, about fairness is mutuality. That imposition of some concept of mutuality, it doesn't happen naturally. Okay. And it can be a very long process to get to the point where the individual, the man that doesn't have any sort of immediate biologic consequences to the sex act, for it to come around, for the mores to come around and really say, okay, dude, you got to really take it up a notch here. You need to challenge yourself more. There needs to be some self-limiting. So, there's just so many ways. It's just not fair. I mean, women have all of these biologic consequences and emotional consequences, and they have to button it down, before the men do. There's a long stretch where mutuality is evolving into place. It's not there to begin with, and it can't be fiated into place either, because that'll be disruptive. Yep.
Well, it could be too why women tend to mature a lot quicker than men.
Yeah.
Especially as they reach their 20s and that, and beyond, because pain and suffering are essential for evolutionary progress, and they experience, with their emotions too, just more genuine pain.
Yeah, yeah.
And men just shake it off a little easier because they're so linear and they, mm-hmm. They don't hold on to that wound.
Right. Right. All right, let's keep going here.
The modern idea of sex equality is beautiful and worthy of an expanding civilization, but it is not found in nature. When might is right, man lords it over woman. When more justice, peace, and fairness prevail, she gradually emerges from slavery and obscurity. Women's social position is generally varied inversely with the degree of militarism in any nation or age.
Right, if you didn't get it immediately when they said peace, right, they explain it basically in that last sentence about the inverse correlation to the degree of militarism. And then you go, oh yeah, that's right, we've talked about that. All right, obviously, once you start pushing, definitively into nationhood and territorial statehood, beyond that, so that you're starting to transition away from that very, very indispensable aspect of war in driving things from tribe to nation. The physical differential starts to be less significant, and naturally, in the evolutionary process, women will not be at such an immediate disadvantage in the society. Right? They can be. Remember how they talked about their, they didn't function, in some spectacular way in a crisis situation and those sorts of things. I mean, that's less of a significant element up front in the society. Then notice, besides the peace and militarism aspect, notice that we have justice and fairness. Okay, and, so for the first thing you might think of, oh yeah, first just, next fair, moving up the levels of meaning. Right, from the first to the second, right? But besides that, just, pause for a second. Oh, they actually use the word justice, right? I mean, justice is applied law. Oh, so we have, we're thinking about having some at least early concept of law in play, not just the more system. Okay, in order to technically have justice. So yeah, there's some rudimentary statehood concepts coming into play if you have genuine law coming into play. And then you're building upon that, taking it up from that individuality of I demand justice, right? We need to have a mutuality thing here. It isn't all about me. So this needs to be fair, not merely just. Yeah. But anyway, when all is said and done, three paragraphs in a row talking about fairness. So you can just see whether you think about moving up levels of meaning, getting to fairness, or moving along the developmental epics so that you've gotten a lot of the security stuff out of sort of immediate dominance, in the security age, and you're moving into the material comfort era, or thinking about tribes to nations to states, all these different ways you can see that they're indicating that there's an evolutionary development going on, that you're moving forward, you're progressing. All right, let's see, anything else there? It's kind of fun that they say, the modern idea of sex equality is beautiful. Mm-hmm. Isn't that an interesting little way to say it? So again, pointing out that, right, I mean, that equal word is a spirit word, and that, to get there genuinely, you're getting into the existential beauty, truth, goodness triplet, and you begin to be motivated by a sense of beauty.
Why did they use the word idea instead of ideal?
because they're, remember how we kind of talked about that you, you're initially challenged to separate ideal from idea and to have a genuine sense of directly spiritual equality. But, it starts to come into play as a shadow cast down upon your ideas. Initially, unconsciously, ideals are casting a shadow down onto ideas. And so you get these more charged ideas. Then, you're going to start to get ideologies, ignorantly out of those ideas. But that's what they're, like I said, it's with the beautiful and everything. They're just pointing out that you're not way, you don't have a very high conscious discrimination of everything, but you definitely have a more at least unconscious personal influence coming into play, getting down there into your ideas about material issues. Okay, like the relationship between the material sexes. Okay, let's see. Let's keep going.
But man did not consciously nor intentionally seize women's rights and then gradually and grudgingly give them back to her. All this was an unconscious and unplanned episode of social evolution. When the time really came for woman to enjoy added rights, she got them, and all quite regardless of man's conscious attitude. Slowly but surely, the mores change so as to provide for those social adjustments which are a part of the persistent evolution of civilization. The advancing mores slowly provided increasingly better treatment for females. Those tribes which persisted in cruelty to them did not survive.
Right, because you have less super additive consequence, and so in the long run, right, survival of the fittest.
And you can see that today. You probably saw in the news. Mm-hmm. 345 miles of women in India holding their hands mm-hmm. because they want to be able to go into the temple.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not allowed in there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's sort of like, it's time. You know what I mean? It's sort of like, interesting how that, that's a lot to think about that.
Interesting, it happens in India too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and think about the things that they're pointing out in the beginning of that paragraph, where, like I was saying, we haven't gone way down the road here into advanced state of civilization. I mean, so it's not like, oh, I definitely have the concept of rights, and I understand that technically women have rights, and so. Because I know they have rights, I'm going to take those rights away. It's like, no, you right? You aren't even thinking about rights, right? Initially. There's no concept of rights because you haven't really gotten into that budding statehood sort of mentality about things. So that's the point they're making at the beginning there. And when you do have the concept of rights, to turn around and say, well, as far back as we know, for thousands of years, men have taken away women's rights. It's like, no. See, that's a very unfortunate false interpretation of history that women can make, once they kind of themselves become aware of the concept of rights and that they might have them.
So, if it's not good for women to not have, rights, is it also true that it's not good for men to have rights, and that would set the system off cattywampus again?
Yeah, we're coming up on that. That's coming up here later in the section.
Right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. See. Yeah. So logically, that's in play, and so sure enough. Few paragraphs down the road here, we're going to get to that, and the Revelators will bring up that very issue. We'll talk about that here in just a little bit. Now then the other thing that's in the middle there, notice how they're stating it directly, something we talk about all the time. When the time really came, and the fact they say really, so it's kind of coming down from eternity, in other words, when the time really came for women to enjoy added rights, she got them, and all quite regardless of man's conscious attitude. Okay? And it's so important again. Especially, see, we're mostly talking directly to women here first. To understand that initially everything is progressing in spite of ourselves. Like I say all the time, and they're saying it directly there. That quite regardless. Okay, so in other words, initially in that early phase of evolution, all the progress is basically in spite of ourselves. No matter how much it might seem otherwise. And you know, and it becomes all the more difficult when you start to see some apparent spectacular social heroes. You know, and you conclude falsely, oh, well, it's all about that spectacular social hero made that happen, you know, and I have this other ideal that I can envision way off in the distance, and I'm going to be that spectacular hero, and I'm going to make that happen too. No, that's not the way it works. They're trying to stress that. It doesn't matter how much it appears that that's the way it works, that it's all about Gandhi or, you know, Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton or Martin Luther King Jr., you know, or whatever, okay? I mean, yes, they played a role, but they're not the originator of the change. They're just, you know, a mechanism in it. I mean, evolution is what's the originator of the change.
They're markers of evolution.
And it's juxtaposed with it.
Right, I mean, sure, coincidentally, in the supremacy of the evolutionary process, there will be a leader if that's needed in, you know, in some sort of a change, okay? But it's, you know, and see, when you take this all the way, it's super important because it gets to the why the book is here, why there's an emergency. Because the more we think that it's not evolution, it's man, the more you're falling right into the Lucifer line of thinking.
Yep.
That's Lucifer's thought.
But aren't we a product of it, or part of evolution?
Sure, right. But that's the whole point.
Does that mean you sit around and do nothing?
Evolution, no, of course it doesn't. It's not a dichotomy. Yeah, but just you have to remember, evolution originates us. We don't originate evolution.
So does that mean that we have to recognize the parts of the evolution that's going on and find out how we can relate to those to move forward?
If you want to be an effective agent, you know, that might even get written up in history, you know, and maybe that's, you know, evolution will work with even that selfish desire. The reason you're doing it is because you'd like to be writ large in history. I mean, you need to develop the wisdom and the insight to notice kind of where things are, and you could work with that evolutionary process and help to be part of that transitional machinery. But it's very foolish to think that you don't need to really assess the lay of the land, right? You've got it in your head, and you can just superimpose that upon the external world. Okay, and make it change like you can visualize change. At the very best, you will ultimately you'll ultimately fail because you're not going to turn the evolutionary knob of the grand universe and evolve the supreme, no matter how much you squint and try to exert your will and how much zeal you have. It won't work. I mean, it might appear to work short term. But it'll fall apart because it's not supported by the evolutionary process. You can pass a constitutional amendment called prohibition, but it's obviously wasn't part of the evolutionary scheme, no matter how much it might idealistically be good, quote unquote, because it got undone.
Have another drink.
Right? you know, so you got to keep that in mind. Yeah, John?
Well, you know, there's a whole thing, I'm having a problem with this because of the whole supreme aspect.
Mm-hmm.
It says, you know, mankind does not ascend effortlessly in the universe, neither does the supreme evolve without purposeful and intelligent action.
Right.
Creatures do not attain perfection by mere passivity, nor can the spirit of the supreme factualize the power of the Almighty without unceasing service ministry to the finite creation.
Right, so I'm coming around to that. I'm not rejecting that, but I'm just trying to put that in context.
He was going to give a question.
Yeah.
I'm trying to understand, this is my question, in terms of the difference between what I know, you know, from having studied this for a long time, in terms of, you know, you got to act. You can't just,
right.
You do have to act.
Yes, you do.
You have to act purposely in where you feel that and it's all inside of what you think is the right thing to do in the situation, etc. Even though, as you say, if you're not here, it's going to happen, may perhaps happen anyway, one way or another. But I do think God uses us all in his overall plan, in every step of our evolution through eternity. Otherwise, right. What's the point?
Right. See, so I was building up to that,
okay.
Right? It's just, so I put in the intermediate step. I introduced reflection about, well, is this a wise thing to do now, or is it a wise thing to do it this way, as opposed to just, this needs to be done, right? This is, all we're trying to do is, remember, the revelators make a huge point, along what you're trying to say. I mean, much stronger than what you just read. They say religionists may not always act wisely. They may even act irreligiously, but they act. Right. Because until there's genuine action, there isn't genuine persons act, minds function.
Is that okay? How you take potential into actual?
I mean, there must be action. But and actually there's not a problem with action. There isn't an emergency because people aren't acting. There's an emergency because people are acting now. We're spiritual enough that there's actually more action instead of just reaction going on the planet. But that action is ever more unwise.
They're not thinking about it.
Right.
Reflecting or
right.
Looking before
it's, the leaves. It's, so again, there's not a spiritual emergency. There isn't an absence of action. There's a philosophic emergency. Right? That action's all those, the greater and greater amounts of action that there really are, there really is not wise. That's what's leading to the emergency. Okay, so, so the reason I set up what appeared to be a dichotomy that was causing a lot of tension there is, it's just, one has to first recognize that, the evolutionary process is ultimately in charge. So this whole bit of acting, like Jesus acting, and even with lots of wisdom, insight, and foresight, you'll still go, oops, that didn't work like I planned. Okay? Jesus is a great example of this. Okay? Because even for him, it's very difficult to figure out what the biggest picture, the total finite, really needs on this world right now. Okay, but that didn't, and he kind of knew that, but it didn't stop him from acting. He went ahead and acted and went, oops, okay, that didn't quite work what I want. So let me pause for a second, reflect some more, and let's see if my next action, can be a little bit wiser, take into a little bit more account the facts on the ground. Because theory is always wonderful until when you actually try to put something in play, then you discover, there's some issues here that, aren't going the way I thought they were going to go. And so, we must act, especially since we're thinking about going from progressing in spite of ourselves to starting to progress because of ourselves, that means action is even more required for that advancing phase. But it just means that wisdom, insight, and foresight are all the more required. What are wisdom, insight, and foresight about? Are they about insight into the details of the Mori system? Wisdom about the way people are currently rationalizing things, what's called conventional wisdom. Is that what you think of when you think of wisdom? What are wisdom, insight, and foresight about? Are they relative to man? No, they're relative to the cosmos. Right? Those are ways of discerning the nature of objective reality, and considering that first and before you try to deal with all the subjective relativities of the moment in space and time that you find yourself in wanting to act. Okay, that's the key.
Of actions to me, you know, there's the kind of action that is on the, what I call the ministry side, where you're acting, you know, with loving kindness towards people on a day as you pass by, so to speak.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's not necessarily a planned action. Mm-hmm. And what, you know, and then there's the other kind, which is, okay, how do I get this book out of your lap and out of everybody else's lap, type thing?
Yeah, or how do I improve the functioning of Congress? Or right, right. Okay. See, and those two modes. There is a fourth epical revelation for the first mode you were talking about, and a fifth epical revelation for the second mode. Right. That whole bit of your action, personal action to an individual, that love and service of the fourth epical revelation.
That goes on for infinity.
Yeah, right. And that's very important. There was a whole epical revelation directed just to that issue. And that should be in play. You know, and you may discover as you kind of get to know yourself better, as you mature into your 20s and stuff, oh, that's really where I fit in to the equation. I'm really geared for that personal individual ministry of taking my personal realization of divine fellowship, my relationship to genuine love, and putting it into practice as a fruit of the Spirit in the external world as loving service. But see that's you know, well right no well the thing is the reason I said but is the thing we're always struggling with is that's not directly what this book is about. See, you know, it talks about that because, like I said, that's a predicate. Okay, but so often what they're really addressing is not, you know, that an individual could use genuine spiritual engagement from another individual, you know, and so that kind of that individual has a relatively an emergency situation. They really, really, you know, have a spiritual deficit in their life, and you could bring that spiritual illumination into their life. But that's not the emergency that brought us the fifth epical revelation. It's not a first miler emergency. It's a second miler emergency, in a sense. You know, it goes beyond that, those immediate things.
It doesn't exclude that.
It doesn't exclude it. See, it builds upon it. Five is four plus one. See, it by definition buils upon the fourth.
Yeah. I didn't mean to digress.
No. You know, it's important to flesh this out because this is one of the things that's really challenging about, you know, if you're coming with very much a motivation of, I want to really be an agent of love and service, and I found the Arantia book, and I need to read all the pages and figure out what it's telling me about love and service and how it's going to improve that. It's like, well, okay, the paleontology papers are not telling you anything about that, et cetera. You know, Ultimatons is not going to, right. That's the thing. The fifth epical revelation is so much more than that. You know, and even when you get to something as intimate as marriage, see, what we're discovering is the big issue that they want to present relative to marriage is not the interpersonal things per se. It's the social consequences that stem from that fundamental dual unit, okay? Those are the things they want to really address. You know, as we're, like I said, we're building up to an exclamation point, and you know, this is all going to be just obvious what I'm saying. I mean, what they talk about, right, is not sort of personal or even relationship per se issues. It's system issues. It's society issues that we're focusing on up front, and the degree to which when we do that, going paragraph by paragraph through this book, that it feels like we're not properly reminding everyone about the individual personal issues, we should probably pause like we just did and remind everyone, okay, that the book is not dismissing that. It's not even really setting it aside. It just appears that it is, okay? It's just that what they, you know, they're saying yes, and we need to also talk seriously about the civilizational issues, okay? Okay. all right. Let's see here now. Where were we? Oh, yeah, we did the cruelty to them and did not survive, yeah. All right, nice. So we got to progress in spite of themselves. Just making sure we got all the key things there.
Slowly but surely.
Yeah, I think we got everything there. So, so now we're obviously, you know, it's like, well, okay, so if you finally start to get some progress with the status of women in society, are there new issues that develop, or is it all smooth sailing from then on? It's like, no, as always, you know, okay? Once you get the first issues solved, you discover the second issues are more problematic than the first issues, even though the first issues seemed like they were infinitely problematic. You know, I mean, we were talking about gradually emerging from slavery and obscurity. That sounds like, you know, how could it get worse than that? Well, it could go from individual slavery and obscurity to, you know, a civilizational emergency that gets solitary messengers, you know, given assignments to write papers and stuff, okay? Yeah. All right, what else do they say here?
It's going from the natural to the unnatural.
Yeah.
It's not natural to be equal. You know? Mm-hmm. And it's
inequality all over.
You don't really have problems until you try to be equal.
Yeah.
I mean, right. Everything's...
Yeah, and then you got to figure out exactly how that works because it's complicated. And you know, and as soon as you're doing something unnatural, it's a double-edged sword. It's like you can do it falsely, or you know, or truly. And how do you know? Okay.
The Adamites and Noddites accorded women increased recognition, and those groups which were influenced by the migrating Andites have tended to be influenced by the Edenic teachings regarding women's place in society.
Okay, so they were just stressing all this evolutionary stuff. But you can see, you know, and we were feeling some tension. The next thing they say is, well, okay, there are, you know, the first and second epical revelations, and even if there was a rebellion and a fault, they still had an influence through the Adamites and the Noddites of modeling a more enlightened interplay between men and women. And it was very impactful. That whole bit of that you had these groups being influenced, you know, by subsequently the Andites going out everywhere. They were definitely influenced by that, the evolutionary peoples. So that kind of brings in that whole issue. It's like, well, what about me as an individual acting? You know, should I be trying to do a Gandhi thing? You know? Because there seem to be positive consequences to what Gandhi did. And it's like, well, yeah, that's that whole bit with exactly how the first and second epical revelations, how those, the prince and his staff, then Adam and Eve and their descendants, how they challenge the people as sort of a catalyst, and yet not do it in a way that turns a blind eye to the big picture of evolution, so that they're in rebellion when they do that. You know, there's obviously some subtle mastery to that. You know, to do that properly, to not overplay that. But again, that's what I said. I mean, just each of us individually, when we act, we have to be as much like, say, the prince's staff is supposed to act, where they have wisdom, insight, and foresight. They're acting, but they're not just, you know, ignoring, well, these people are in the nutrition epic right now, not in the, you know, the era of light and life, and we need to engage them in that modality to try to foster them moving to the security age next, right? Or if they've got just, and the next thing we foster is fair, right? And then the next thing we foster is patient, and then the next, you know, they don't go, oh, they got just, let's go right to love. Okay. So that very methodical developmental sense of it.
Just the other day, I just found myself reflecting on what we've been reading here, and I never saw this before, but this current stalemate in government between the two parties. I mean, this is a, to me, it's a classic example of mother-dominated family and father-dominated family.
That's why they talked about that transition from mother family to father family, because there's several things that aren't immediately apparent about that. You know, your first thought is, well, wait, maybe there, you know, it's a net negative in going to a father family, and we should go back to mother family. So that's why they laid that all out, so you could reflect on it. And it's like, well, okay, no, it's not like it immediately appears. It seems like it's preventing certain things, but not really. In the long haul, it actually produces more liberty than you can get in that initial mode. Yeah. There's a number of things that the book points out like that. It's like, you know, because they know we are having an ever greater tendency to want to go back to those old forms. And it's because we don't understand, we've forgotten the lessons learned historically that, you know, everyone was complaining up front, but then they discovered down the road, oh, actually, this is actually better. I didn't think it was going to be better. But when all is said and done, I see it actually is better. And so they need to remind us of those evolutionary lessons we've lost so that we don't, unfortunately, go back to an old form. Yeah. Okay. Let's keep going here.
The early Chinese and the Greeks treated women better than did most surrounding peoples. But the Hebrews were exceedingly distrustful of them. In the Occident, woman has had a difficult climb under the Pauline doctrines, which became attached to Christianity. Although Christianity did advance the mores by imposing more stringent sex obligations upon man. Women's estate is little short of hopeless under the peculiar degradation which attaches to her in Mohammedanism, and she fares even worse under the teachings of several other Oriental religions.
And so you notice it went from the early Chinese to...
Yes.
All right, yeah, but when all is said and done, things have unraveled, yeah. And notice the thing that really strikes you there. It's like, whoa, all of a sudden we're talking about Pauline doctrines? Yeah, yeah. This whole bit of moving into the more sophisticated stages of this is a, you know, as we all know, and we pause and think about it for a second, oh yeah, that's a very, very recent phenomenon. We're talking 20th century, right? I mean, it couldn't even happen in the 19th century. Some of these things, you know, that are really giving more social equality to women, right, literally didn't happen until the 20th century and into the 20th century a ways. So, so all of a sudden we're talking about current issues and laboring under Paul's limited perspective that was injected into Christianity. But you notice they give you the contrast. It's like, well, although Christianity did advance the mores by imposing more stringent sex obligations upon man, and they, like they mentioned before, that sort of tardy imposition upon men. We'll see here in a couple paragraphs that they indirectly pick up the Pauline issue again here. Let's see, anything else there?
Hopeless.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, I was going to mention. Yeah, it's a little short of hopeless, and then and it's like, well, she fares even worse. So in other words, that must be just basically hopeless. Not little short of hopeless, but just plain hopeless. Yeah, I mean, and here's an example where this whole bit about us acting, there's no escaping that once one part of the planet gets a more enlightened sense about this, once there is communication and transportation like we have now, this is going to alter the evolutionary process. It becomes more and more difficult for there to be isolated, very backward cultures. You know, Saudi Arabia just eventually has to start thinking about women driving, you know, and things like that, because they're just too interacting with everyone else. It's just, there's no, you know, even when you go to extremes like North Korea, you can't cut the rest of the world's cultural influence off. You know, and it slowly trickles in and influences them. So we see, without even sort of trying to come up with some grand plan of action to change the world, just the fact that you are a more awakened individual and you talk to other people on the planet or move about to other places on the planet, it's going to happen kind of just naturally that you will influence the world, you know, and maybe the if you have a little less grand scheme planning to it, maybe it will all happen coincidentally a little more wisely. You know, if it kind of just happens in the natural interplay. Yeah, see, they're kind of reminding you of that between, remember how they say that whole bit about the contrast between world trade organizations, you know, helping with, you know, moving things forward in contrast to visionary peace planning? You know, just kind of the natural interactions of people because you want to, you know, change a dollar bill for a knick-knack or whatever. You know, things get spread out and you get, there's an influence. So you notice what is in juxtaposition, the Andites going out and influencing. See, in the same way, you know, it just naturally there's an influence. You don't have to necessarily think in grand plans of overnight transformation. Be just a little seed that ministers as you pass by, you know?
There is one problem. Yep. We have led thousands of people into our country with this peculiar degradation.
Right,
and
yeah.
They have power like I could never have imagined.
Yeah, I mean, right. That's the flip side of that positive transportation, you know, improvement thing I was just saying. Because, yeah, those places that have a peculiar degradation, they start filtering into the leading edge of civilization, the Western world, and demanding Sharia law.
And they're actually getting, like I told you last week, San Diego School Board voted to honor Sharia law. Like what?
Well,
anyhow,
lives down there.
Yeah.
I'll rave about it, so I won't say anything.
Right. Yeah, it can be very distressing when you see the, you know, when you see why the book is here, right? When the emergency starts to become apparent to you, you know, that everything is, you know, this tentative hold we had on the beginnings of something much better for mankind. It can easily just be washed over by the unenlightened masses. There are billions of them.
That's right. Okay. All these machine guns.
And so, yeah, you know, that brings in this whole issue of how's that going to play out? You know, not to mention, like we've, you know, when we were reading about the Chinese back in the Andite expansion in the Orient, and they were giving us those little ominous statements at the end. It's like, well, and then there's the Chinese that are going to start to be about out and about in the world. And you'll have lots of fun issues with that, too. yeah, we already had fun issues when the Japanese decided they want to kind of go off the island. You know, that was initially kind of problematic. So, yeah, there's a lot of difficulties, you know, when these cultures are mobile. Was there something somewhere else? Okay. Let's keep going here.
Science, not religion, really emancipated woman. It was the modern factory which largely set her free from the confines of the home. Man's physical abilities became no longer a vital essential in the new maintenance mechanism. Science so changed the conditions of living that manpower was no longer so superior to woman power.
Just, there's a little example. I mean, everyone knows how much was written about the evils of the Industrial Revolution and enslaving everyone and whatnot. You know, they're saying, well, okay, you got to let it play out a little bit. And guess what leads to the emancipation of women? Not visionary planning and stuff, okay? Yeah. Science. You know, there's all these things. It doesn't appear like, it appears actually this is going to do the opposite of what I think should happen. No. Trust the evolutionary process. You might be surprised that it ends up being exactly what needs to happen to get the result you're looking for. The result you can't get any other way. The result you can't get when you try change without growth. Right? And you don't get goodness, you get evil. Yep.
You know, factory work, you're a cog in the system. And to understand the system, it's just like these guys, you know, in trailer parks and trying to figure out how to get the engine working, you know. It's a system, and it takes system thinking. And in order to be a successful cog in that factory, you have to have an appreciation of the system, or you're not going to last.
These are the things
seem like slavery.
These are the things we got to figure out going forward.
A slave to the system.
They're referring more to the time when they wrote this book to, when all the men had to go off to war and work in the factories because they didn't have to work in the factories.
Right.
And then they found out that,
but don't you think that they can do the same thing we can do?
We don't want to get into the science of social evolution here. Okay, that gets into complicated stuff. But just just the basic philosophic principles, remember, is what they're trying to give us first. And a lot of it, again, we're not going to be the institutors of the new system. These systems will evolve. But they want to try to help us appreciate what the genuine causality is, so that when we are activist minded, we're not looking in the opposite direction. They point out what actually is effective, and if you want more of that kind of effect, try to see if you can foster that, at least the truth, if not the fact, of the key elements that they point out to us in the book. Okay, keep going.
These changes have tended toward women's liberation from domestic slavery and have brought about such a modification of her status that she now enjoys a degree of personal liberty and sex determination that practically equals man's. Once a woman's value consisted in her food-producing ability, but invention and wealth have enabled her to create a new world in which to function, spheres of grace and charm. Thus has industry won its unconscious and unintended fight for women's social and economic emancipation. And again has evolution succeeded in doing what even revelation failed to accomplish.
Okay, so there's the sentence that I paraphrase all the time, right? That which revelation fails to accomplish, evolution always achieves, is the way I usually say it, something like that. I'm paraphrasing that. But let's go to the specific and just look how stark this is, this specific example of that. Okay, what things are they holding up, that are sort of the hallmarks of the evolutionary process? Supposed unmitigated evils like wealth and industry. Right? How much are those two things demonized today? So what are they saying here? It's like, no, it's wealth and industry that emancipated women. Okay. Thus, has industry won its unconscious and unintended. See, it doesn't have to. Doesn't have to be all these intended things. Behind your activism. Right? Unintended fight for women's social and economic emancipation. Okay, well, that's challenging enough. But then think specifically about that final sentence. What is it, the revelation we're talking about? They alluded to it a couple paragraphs back. Jesus of Nazareth. That which Jesus of Nazareth failed to accomplish, wealth and industry achieved. Right, that's the specific example. Right, we all know how much he put forward, setting up a woman's core and, having them lead a worship service almost immediately after he did that, and et cetera. And how much Mary Magdalene became a preacher like Peter.
It lasted 10 minutes.
Right. But it wasn't
even recorded in the Bible.
See, again, not only, would have Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton failed 2,000 years ago, Michael of Nevadon, incarnated as Jesus of Nazareth, couldn't do it.
He was just sowing seeds. Right? Fail.
See, right. But see, that's the thing. See, because he didn't have delusions.
Right.
See, so he didn't fail, in that sense. Right. But that effort didn't take off like wildfire, as one might imagine. It's like, well, anything that he kind of sowed the seed of, the seed would blossom instantly. No, the seed blossoms over time according to the evolutionary process. Right? See, the whole point is that's the way when we want to act, we want to think the same way. Don't act to be the builder of the end state. Act to be the initiator of the beginning state. Because after all, what's allowing you to act? Your personality. Where did your personality come from? The Universal Father. Is the Universal Father the consummator of universe destiny? No. Is he about the end point? No, he's the initiator, not the consummator. Right? So if you're going to use the gift from the Father and act, do it properly as an initiator, not a culminator. Right? The culminator is the whole. Right? Like of the finite evolutionary process. Okay? Not any of the parts. But all the parts have been given a great gift from the Universal Father, the individuality of the parts, to be an initiator like him in your own little way.
And that's the second part of the parable of the sower. And then I'll tell you the rest of it.
And when all is said and done, that's what Jesus did. Seems reasonable since he decided in his public ministry, instead of trying to reveal this God the Supreme, to continue to reveal God the Father, right? That when all is said and done with his actions, they were initiators. Right? That's the key. That's it's humble, properly humble, to see your actions as an initiating action. If you think of them as anything besides that, there's a word that starts with P for that. It's the opposite of humility, pride. Right? And when there isn't that humility to just be an initiator, and everyone is prideful and trying to be a consummator with their personal, newfound personal nature, that leads to an emergency that mobilizes the super universe to produce this book that's in my lap. That's what this is about. See, again, like what I was trying to explain earlier on when this tension first started. Okay.
The initiating of that wealth and industry in America, I mean, when you read science books and the inventions, primarily, 95% to 99% of them, and the initiator impulse, but then women seem more adept at taking it over in those later stages, you know, when the system, when it develops into a system. A lot of your middle management back in the '90s, mid-90s, was taken over by women.
A lot of times it's very difficult for a man to be an upholder if he's too directional. You know, he immediately goes zooming forward instead of staying underneath the uphold.
Exactly what those inventors did. Zoomed under multiple cups of coffee. Or whatever.
I mean, it's attempting to initiate a recognition in each of our minds, yes. In terms of the person that will really lead us step by step forward and not just initiate the process, that's the magisterial son, as the philosophic uplifter, you know, that kind of walks along with us. You know, this is just plop, you know, as an initiating step, you know. All right, let's keep going.
The reaction of enlightened peoples from the equitable mores governing woman's place in society has indeed been pendulum-like in its extremeness. Among industrialized races, she has received almost all rights and enjoys exemption from many obligations, such as military service. Every easement of the struggle for existence has redounded to the liberation of woman. And she has directly benefited from every advance toward monogamy. The weaker always makes disproportionate gains in every adjustment of the mores in the progressive evolution of society.
Okay, we won't play out all the stuff that's kind of between the lines there, because they're going to do that in the subsequent paragraphs. But but the thing obviously that paragraph is pregnant with, even more so that since we're reading it at the beginning of the 21st century instead of at the beginning of the 20th century, is how much this has gotten confused, let's say, okay?
I wouldn't read that last sentence to my wife.
But before we get to that, they want to put in the exclamation point paragraph. Okay, so here it is, this next paragraph, that it's speaking directly. Okay, so saying to the women of the world, at least the women of the leading edge of the civilized world, okay, now that you have, through a complicated evolutionary process, most of it unintended and whatnot, found some degree of social freedom and hence personal liberty, what are you going to do with that? So let's read it.
In the ideals of pair marriage, woman has finally won recognition, dignity, independence, equality, and education. But will she prove worthy of all this new and unprecedented accomplishment? Will modern woman respond to this great achievement of social liberation with idleness, indifference, barrenness, and infidelity? Today in the 20th century, woman is undergoing the crucial test of her long world existence.
Exclamation point. And of course, the very fact that they literally said 20th century there helps. Right? Because, okay, we're 100 years hence, say, and so how's the test going?
I think it's going well. if you use those points that they put there, I don't see a lot of idleness and barrenness. Pardon me, but...
right?
Barrenness. I see.
You see mixed results.
Yeah.
See? And so it depends on where your eye tends to be focused, right? But if you step back and get more objective about it, what you should see is mixed results. Some instances, okay. Other such instances, no. Right? It's not going well. You know, you're getting more and more rogue females in some parts of our society.
Well, on TV, and you hear about, but overall.
Now, for instance, the family amongst the more wealthy, the family is still holding together quite well. Amongst the middle class, families being very seriously challenged. And amongst the lower class, poor, it's almost been completely obliterated.
It never was there.
Yeah, or barely, you know, it was just starting to get there, and, you know, and it was erased, you know, before it really got into place. Yeah. And again, remember, you know there has to be some issues here. It can't be all sunshine and lollipops, or the book wouldn't be in my lap.
Let's talk about that first.
Okay.
Look, you know, you've both chimed in on the family in the poorer situations. But is that more the cause of the man than the woman?
Well, like they tried to point out, in most of these things, both are equally, at fault. You know, both men and women have their blind spots, their Achilles heels that feed into this. You know, like when they're talking about.
Well, the point I'm bringing up is the instinct aspect of the mother in the family. That doesn't go away no matter what socialism.
No. I mean, the instinct doesn't go away, but it can be overruled. See, so what you're seeing, remember how where was that?
Even though it's overruled, it's still always there. You have to consciously continue to overrule.
Yes, right. You see, but that's the issue. How many women are consciously overruling it, at least for a few decades, because that's the way they were taught in college, and then eventually that maternal instinct, that's never really gone away, they've just been suppressing it, says, I really, really would like to have a child. Well, okay, two issues. One, you're not married. And two, you can't have children anymore. You're too old.
You don't have any eggs left. So you're talking about something different than I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. I was more talking about the quality of the family when it becomes into existence. You're talking about not even coming into existence because of that aspect of it.
I mean,
people
but
choosing not to have children. I mean, and
but again,
you're totally right. I mean, look at Japan.
Why is the middle class evaporating?
It's an
in the Western world. It's not because somehow some mysterious force from above is evaporating the middle class. I mean, we're just reading about why there is a middle class. I mean, it's predicated on the family. Right? If the middle class is disappearing, there must be forces in play, and we need to figure out what they are, that is disrupting the family in the middle class.
Chris, isn't it economic, though? I know a lot of white people, for instance, had one or two kids because we thought we can't really afford more, and
other
people are having five and six kids when they can't afford it.
Like I said, we don't want to venture off too deeply, in this venue into the science of these issues. Okay, I mean, this is really just not possible. But I would suggest to you, if you reflect on this, what are the influences that have destroyed, to such a degree, the middle class family? There are many, many different things. You can point to a lot of different issues. Okay, but I think you will eventually, if you're very thorough in your reflection about it, when all is said and done, the very big issue is economic. Right? There are forces in play that are making it, economically impossible. It's like, remember how they keep bringing that up, it's especially problematic when humans get very demonizing about economics and stuff. it's like, well, okay, but World Trade Organizations are going to do a lot more than visionary peace planning, like they say, those sorts of things. I mean, that the laws of the house economy, do you suppose the laws of the house might have something to do with families and the home, right? The literalness of the word economy is the laws of the house,
right? What do you mean by demonized?
Money is the root of all evil, wealth is innately evil, capital is evil, etc. All these sorts of, notions that are constantly being put forward in our society. You can forget about democracy if you don't have a middle class. Right, and you can forget about a middle class if there are no middle class families.
And there aren't because of economics.
Right, and it's right. So
manufacturing these made a lot of my friends' parents.
Right,
got them through a lot with their families right. and their limited families and the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
And those are all gone.
Right, yeah.
And every leader until this one has said they're all going away. Forget about it.
So again, put this a little bit forward, because see, if you want to know, if I'm going to be active, not just relative to the fourth epical revelation, but active relative to the fifth, this is the kind of stuff that, you're doing. It's not just a matter of, well, I need to love my neighbor more. Okay, you need to do that. But that's not going to fix, the middle-class family problem, right? See, and like I said, that's why I alluded to the first miler, second miler thing, right? I mean, there have been many Christians in the last 2,000 years, regardless of Pauline doctrines and atonement and whatnot, okay, nonetheless, there have been many magnificent Christians who have done love and service like none of us will ever do, okay? They are writ large in history for a reason, okay? And we won't be in that regard, okay? But what does the book say about that? Okay, but mankind still languishes and stumbles along in moral darkness, because morality is about the cosmos and that wisdom, insight, foresight thing. It's not just about your personal inspiration to engage someone in loving service. Okay? And so that's the difficult thing. You can do that and do that we can try to make everyone on the planet a first miler. Like a Mother Teresa, but mankind is still going to languish and stumble along in moral darkness. It's a very stark thing that they tell you up there.
She might have been a second.
Yeah.
She's pretty.
Okay. I mean, I'm purposely using her, as a poster child for my statement, just to challenge it. Okay. Don't think that. Well, if there are those that, are, no. I mean, there are so few second milers. Okay, just like it's sad to record that so few persons, same words, right? Right? This, that's that courageous and independent cosmic thinking.
And, it talks about in paper 195 about being careful about taking God out of society, which is a whole other issue.
Right, of course, right. Because challenging yourself to be genuinely religious and not just spiritual. Brings you into relationship with the cosmos. See, that's the thing. I mean, it's true religion. The true means the cosmos is in play. Okay. You've gone beyond just evolutionary, quote-unquote, religion, right? Where the cosmos is only in play superconsciously. Remember that this is, if they're doing an exclamation point in a book, this has got to be a big issue about why the book is here. And it doesn't take much reflection to figure out why. We're reading three papers about saying that women are a very foundational element to the whole picture. And so if they fail the test, you know, if they start doing, if they start behaving unnaturally and they don't, and they're falsely unnatural, instead of, you know, by grace they're truthfully natural. The hand that rocks the cradle still fraternizes with destiny. We're coming up on that, remember? Okay? Right. If they start to be unnatural because they have the liberty now to be unnatural, they aren't in, you know, intellectual bondage, right? Then you have the test. True and false liberty. Okay, let's keep going here.
Woman is man's equal partner in race reproduction. Hence, just as important in the unfolding of racial evolution. Therefore, has evolution increasingly worked toward the realization of women's rights. But women's rights are by no means men's rights. Woman cannot thrive on men's rights any more than man can prosper on woman's rights.
So I told you, Katie, see, it's coming. There it is. About, you know, and... you know, and taking it to the extreme, like you were kind of hinting at, is, you know, if you don't produce women's rights at the expense of men's rights. It's not a zero-sum game where there's only so many rights to go around. You got to rip them away from men in order to give them to women.
Give me an example of men's rights and women's rights. I mean, I'm missing that.
Right. Well, that's what they're going to talk about here next. I mean, but it's. The difference in the rights is the difference in their spheres of excellence that they're about to talk about here.
It's not necessarily
rights, it's inalienable. Well, see, again, remember the word rights here is in the sense of you know, of how we use that word when we start talking about statehood. You know, it's those sort of more formalized, definitive more elements that in a state you start to call rights. The right to assemble or whatever, you know.
I meant to mention before, and it kind of has to do with this. Mm-hmm. Women sometimes think they're liberated by being more manlike. But they said spheres of grace and charm, and I would never want to give that up. I think it's a precious thing. Mm-hmm. So women's rights would have to do with that. It would be flavored by that.
You know, and by rights, you just mean, you know, that society is going to say, is not going to impose or intrude upon, the women in their sphere having the freedom of expression of that sphere.
It doesn't mean by getting a license to drive a car. That's not a right necessarily.
Well, you know, I mean...
It's deeper
than... I mean, you know, when you think of the Bill of Rights, you don't think of, you know, traffic regulations and stuff, okay? Right, it's the bigger picture issues. Yeah.
Well, no, I've got the same question as John.
Yep.
Because if you have equality, and now we're talking about men's and women's rights, and so they don't.
Right.
We're talking about a difference rather than.
Right. Equal. Right. Again, see, you know, and notice they've mentioned equitable. Right. Remember, you know, like I said, we're jumping ahead and kind of talking about the things we're going to talk about in the next couple of paragraphs here. Okay. I mean, just, you know, you're going to set up an equitable system predicated on equality. You know, but in an equitable system, there are separate spheres.
Yeah.
Right. They aren't interchangeable parts.
We want the differences.
Okay.
Thank God.
You know.
That's the way guys are. I'm not like them.
Okay. But the one thing I wanted to bring out that's a little more mysterious there, but instead of the rights thing, was this: what they're saying in the rest of that paragraph, The fact that both are contributing genetics to the offspring, you know, they say that hence, just as important in the unfolding of racial evolution, therefore has evolution increasingly worked toward the realization of women's rights. And you say, well, wait a minute, I don't understand the physics of that. How does that work? Well, a simple way to think about it is because both are contributing genetics, the offspring might have a tendency to more identify with mom than with dad. You know, and identifying with mom, they listen to what mom is, you know, desiring or complaining about, or, you know, or what her hopes and dreams are, and wants to help to see that happen. And see, that's what they're talking about. In the subtleness of the evolutionary process, even if that woman doesn't have direct voice, because we haven't gotten to that in the social evolutionary process, she has an indirect voice because of her DNA that she contributed, you know, and at the very least, that child might have inclinations like she has. So that's what they're trying to point out, is just how there can be kind of some of the physics of how you can progress in spite of yourself, you know, no matter how much you try to, keep women in obscurity, like they said, you know, put a blanket over them so they have no social manifestation. No, it's impossible. Their DNA is getting into kids. And you can't stop that, no matter what laws you pass, no matter how big a blanket you try to throw over it. Okay, so that's what they're getting at there.
So we're talking about what the circle of influence is of that person.
Yeah, and just how it the genetics, you know, because mind is attuned to genetics, it's slowly over time, people's voices play into the system, even if they don't literally have a social right to have a voice. Okay, even if they don't have the right to vote, they're voting with their DNA. To their children, and their influence is playing into the system, and over time, right? It's not going to happen fast, but over time, it leads to change.
If they choose to have children,
right? Yeah, that's another thing.
Bumper sticker is born.
Yeah.
Says about Jesus, he, when all is said and done, he got to his adult life. He drove forward in the manner of his mother. Now, that may be because she had more Andite blood than Joseph. But, right. It's interesting. Right. He wasn't the wallflower.
Right.
He wasn't a peacenik, you know.
Yeah, right.
Necessarily.
Like I said, that's it. Right. We can see it, you know, in just the way it played out with Jesus, you know, and his genetic inheritance from his mom. Okay, let's keep going here.
Each sex has its own distinctive sphere of existence, together with its own rights within that sphere. If woman aspires literally to enjoy all of man's rights, then, sooner or later, pitiless and emotionless competition will certainly replace that chivalry and special consideration which many women now enjoy, and which they have so recently won from men.
Okay, so like I said, it's the next paragraph. Trying to get you to start to think about those spheres. So, and saying, okay, women have special consideration in this sphere. They have a right to that. You know, like, we could decide, you know, again, you're getting into the physics. I'm not putting forward a specific thing here, but just take an example, like they just mentioned about military service. You know, society can decide that women have the right to not serve in the military, that they can't be, that society can't force them, that they have a right to not. So you could decide that that's one of their rights in their sphere. Again, rights are, very, can be changed and whatnot. But society, needs to set up, decides what, they have a right to here and what, here they're pointing out, women, we could say as a society, women have a right to not have to be crude, like men are naturally.
That's a big one.
Okay. But there's lots of forces that say, no, you're sexist to think like that. No, we should force women right in there, sharp elbows. Okay. I mean, we already have this tension, on a debate stage for president. It's like, well, do you want to be part of my pitiless and emotionless competition or not? If you want to be, well, then you can't say, wait a minute, you can't say that to me, I'm a woman. Because you're saying that you have different rights. It's like, no, you're saying you want to be part of the men's rights, which are pitiless and emotionless. So, okay, you got to pick. See, this is the kind of stuff they're trying to get us to think about. You can't have it both ways. Either you're part of the pitiless and emotionless competition, on the football field, or you are deemed to have different rights. You have a right to not be on the football field.
Or be on the football field with flags or bigger pads.
All right. Yeah, see, again, I mean, we have to figure this out. Like I said, we're not going to decide on the exact specifications here right now.
It's not just either or.
Right. But these, we're very confused right now.
Not all men are that crude anymore. Thankfully, the guys I know are.
But a lot of the women are way more crude now.
Well, I don't really know them
than I think they ever were.
Yeah, the guy's got to ratchet up the crudeness to suppress.
See, and we need to decide. It's like, well, we could all just kind of be crude. That would mean we'd be an early developing civilization. Okay, it's like, well, no, I don't want that. I have dreams of, an advancing civilization. It's like, well, then there has to be refinement from somewhere. Well, let's just impose it by fiat. No, okay, it has to have an evolutionary nature to it. Who's more naturally refined? Women. So you better give them a sphere that fosters that refinement and having a social expression so that men can benefit from that civilizing, refining influence. But if you say, no, you don't have a right for a separate sphere like that where you can be, refined, you need to be crude, right? And we're going to honor you if you're more pitiless than a guy is. We'll give you a CEO job, or something. I mean, again, this is just, we got to figure this out. This is a very complicated issue. Okay, let's keep going.
Civilization never can obliterate the behavior gulf between the sexes. From age to age, the mores change, but instinct, never. Innate maternal affection will never permit emancipated woman become man's serious rival in industry. Forever, each sex will remain supreme in its own domain, domains determined by biologic differentiation and by mental dissimilarity.
And because mind is attuned to the genetics, and the genetics situation is different. Biologic situation is different. Okay, I mean,
just... the word supreme, I love that.
Mm-hmm.
It makes you think each sphere is part of the supreme,
right.
Which is a good thing.
Right, again, see, right. Because not only is there the supreme father, there's the supreme mother. So in supremacy, there's two spheres. One is immanence and the other is transcendence, for instance, right? Relative to supremacy. Again, the important thing here is there's no wiggle room. Civilization never can obliterate. But instinct, never. Innate maternal affection will never permit emancipated woman to become man's serious rival in industry. That whole, again, self-maintenance thing that they brought up at the beginning. Okay, take this, recognize fully what they're saying. Seventh stage of light and life on a world. 10 trillion years from now. No. What they're saying there. Innate maternal affection will never permit emancipated women. How emancipated will women be in the seventh stage of light and life? Okay. But still, it'll never permit her to become man's serious rival in industry.
Wow. Sounds worse than the Lucifer Rebellion.
Okay. It's just, I mean, they're trying to bring it fully to a head. Okay. We have to face this fact. The differential is immutable. Okay? And if it's immutable, if it's like the changeless universal father, if it's like the changeless first source and center of all things and beings, not only can it be changed, right? But it's there for a reason. Yeah. It's supposed to be different forever.
And that's the beauty of it.
Right? And we need to figure out why it's supposed to be different. And not saying, no, that's patriarchy, that there's a difference. No, it's God. Okay, if you want to say it's patriarchy, yeah, it's the overall rule of the universal father who made it that way, who initiated it that way in his infinite wisdom.
One of the differences between these spheres and in the so-called man's sphere, it's hierarchical. In the women's sphere, which is primarily in the home, it's it's not. I mean, a woman will be have her home, not someone else's home. I mean, it's not hierarchical in the same way.
Yeah.
But it is hierarchical as far as deity is concerned. Paradise Trinity has a
downstepping. Right, yeah. Right, see, yeah, that's some of those things. See, like, you know, we can reflect on the hierarchy of Mother Deity, we can reflect on the hierarchy of fathers. Right, see, there are issues in the book that don't seem to have immediate relationship to families and stuff. But you see, she's recognizing, you know, yes, they do, because it's all one system. So what do some of these things teach us? You know, I even gave a little example of considering the difference between the Supreme Mother and the Supreme Father. You know, technically, I guess it's the Mother Supreme. You should say it that way, and not the Supreme Mother. It's the Mother Supreme and the Supreme Father. There's a reason why they're reciprocal like that in their order. I mean, there's all these issues that can be reflected on. Okay. Yep.
What do you suppose is meant by the word industry?
Yeah, then there's that. Which I was kind of challenging you between the lines. And it's like, well, wait a minute. Seventh stage of light and life. Industry is not going to be like what I'm thinking right now. What's industry like in Havona, for instance? Right, is it belching coal-fired power plants? Probably not. Yes, you obviously need to expand it, but they are pointing out that there is a fact of industry, no matter how much things evolve, and there will be this difference still.
Maybe they sell crystals from the sea. Well, just generally, broad stroke it.
Maybe being CEOs of industry versus,
just
that kind of thing.
Think about, like I said, I don't want to go too far here, but just think about what they already alluded to, issues of competition. And how, a man will have his tendency to foster competition, but a woman is like, come on, kids. This isn't a competition. We need to work together as a family. and both of those, for industry to properly work, there has to be competition. In the basic material facts of it, it's like they were saying, it's pretty pitiless and emotionless. It's just a cold, hard material survival of the fittest thing.
It's pretty
Yeah, and it's like, oh, that's so harsh. We don't want to kind of have a company like that. It's like, well, then your company will go out of business because it won't be successful.
That evolves too, doesn't it?
Yeah, but like I'm saying, all that stuff evolves in ways we can't even imagine. Right? I mean, we can't even imagine industry in the post-Bastol Sun Age in a normal world. Okay, but
John has talked about more equitable.
But I'm just trying to point out.
Industry.
Like I said, let's not unpack all the science of it right here, because we're going to take forever on these things. But just broach the subject in your mind, and you can start thinking about it. Let's get the last little bit in here.
Each sex will always have its own special sphere, albeit they will ever and anon overlap. Only socially will men and women compete on equal terms.
Okay, so again, it's just, like I said, let's not try to go into details, but just that little suggestion that we need to think of the spheres, right? The spheres are treated equally socially, but they're different spheres. And that, so those are just the general philosophic suggestions they're giving to you. And I recommend that if you want to think about this more, start by just reflecting and getting zeroed in precisely on the philosophic statements they're making before you try to analytically design a scientific system. Yeah.
Even in today's life, you can see like education is a severe, which both work pretty well in. You can see that. Then mining maybe is another sphere or something which they don't necessarily work.
Some of these things
so
will happen.
It's very easy to see some of the things that are very.
Some of them will happen naturally. You know, like maybe naturally, most journalists will be women, no matter what men and women try to artificially impose. And you're already seeing that. I mean, more and more, there aren't any men in journalism. They're almost all women. Right? And see, and that, and you could say, well, I think that's inappropriate. Well, maybe not. It could be something that it's gotten falsely imposed, or it could be part, let's just see. Maybe that's naturally, maybe that works better.
My son-in-law just became a nurse.
Okay, or whatever.
Always been thought of as, so there's definitely realms, but mm-hmm. I think more what they're trying to say here, which I think that is more than emergencies, is they don't want to see the home go under. Yeah. I mean, the home is really, seems like it's threatened. They talk about that.
Yes.
And, you know, and it's not just in this country, but in a lot of places around the world. And you mentioned, and one of the reasons is because the economics aspect of things. People don't think they have the time to be able to do that, just like they don't have the time to pray. But, so they have to get to some point where they can, as Chris was saying, you can look beyond, you know, the immediate, and look more into, okay, this needs to be done because there's a greater reason behind all this. And the reason is not just, but I've got to say that I'm really noticing this in my children and their friends. They're not looking so much for how much money they can make, whatever. They're much more looking into the quality of their life in their home and in their community. And I'm sure, you know, those of you who have younger children, you know, they're in their, let's say, their 30s or 20s, I don't know if you're seeing that too, but then when you talk to them, that's what they're more interested in. Whereas we were brought up with, you know, it's your value is measured by the size of your checkbook versus, mm-hmm. So that's kind of things that are basically changing, but we didn't get very far.
All right, let's keep going here. Partnership of men, next section here.
Section 6, the partnership of man and woman. The reproductive urge unfailingly brings men and women together for self-perpetuation, but alone does not ensure their remaining together in mutual cooperation, the founding of a home.
Right, so again, starting with just a natural, unnatural contrast. Let's keep going.
Every successful human institution embraces antagonisms of personal interest, which have been adjusted to practical working harmony. And homemaking is no exception. Marriage, the basis of home building, is the highest manifestation of that antagonistic cooperation which so often characterizes the contacts of nature and society. The conflict is inevitable. Mating is inherent. It is natural. But marriage is not biologic. It is sociologic. Passion ensures that man and woman will come together, but the weaker parental instinct and the social mores hold them together.
Okay, so like I said, it's that basic, they're trying to really get you to think about the natural, unnatural contrast. It is natural, like they said there. And that the more sophisticated the society is, when they say sociologic, the more unnatural it is, like we've talked about many times. Right here you see something we haven't, I've mentioned a few times. We have the maternal instinct very definitively, strongly there. No paternal instinct, in parallel. But there is a weak parental instinct, in both. And so, if you have an issue with me saying there's no paternal instinct, it's like, well, no, think about it more closely. Maybe what you're thinking of is parental instinct in the man.
And that's an instinct.
Okay, there is a parental instinct. Okay, but it starts out very weak. The comparison is to the maternal instinct. The maternal instinct is very, very powerful. Okay, but there is a parental instinct, even though there isn't a paternal instinct. Okay, and then they're going to pick that up here in a little bit.
Male and female are practically regarded two distinct varieties of the same species living in close and intimate association. Their viewpoints and entire life reactions are essentially different. They're wholly incapable of full and real comprehension of each other. Complete understanding between the sexes is not attainable.
Okay, so again, kind of in these same definitive statements like we saw before, right? Partial understanding, yeah, of course, and more so as you go forward. In the seventh stage of light and life, there will be a lot of mutual understanding because both will be so transcendent and looking down upon it. But complete understanding between the sexes is not attainable, not even the depths of the seventh stage of light and life. Okay? The viewpoints and entire life reactions are essentially different. Okay? It's not some conspiracy of nurture. If we just change the way we educate people or raise our children or something. Okay. They are wholly incapable. So in the fullness of your relationship to the whole and the individuality of the whole, it's okay, it doesn't change it. Right? They are wholly incapable of full and real comprehension of each other.
Don't they say somewhere that goes all the way up to...
We're about to read that. Okay. you can't have any illusions about this or delusions about it. Okay.
Women seem to have more intuition than men, but they also appear to be somewhat less logical. Woman, however, has always been the moral standard bearer and the spiritual leader of mankind. The hand that rocks the cradle still fraternizes with destiny.
There it is. I jumped to the punchline a little bit ago, but you all know it. Right, and that's what we talked about way back. That maternal instinct, is so definitively put in you, as women from the top down, that you are using the first adjutant naturally, not just as the energy of instinct, but as the spirit of intuition. And that's technically why that sentence is valid. The hand that rocks the cradle still fraternizes with destiny. Right? That means that somehow the end has gotten down to you at the beginning. Right? There's some definitive top-down grace embedded in you, as a woman. And that's what it is. Just that the fact that there's a spirit of something in you naturally, even in a very primitive female, that's not in any primitive male. The males are, you know, and the rest of the female is going to be more just the energy of something. Right? All of those adjutants as the energy of something. Right? But the woman has a little bit of the spirit of something to one of her adjutants. It's just the first, okay? But it's something that a male doesn't have. Okay? So, again, that's why she can be the spark for all this stuff we're talking about, marriage and family. And it's because the spark reached down and was put in her from above. The spirit of something, a spark. Okay. And then the other technical thing in the beginning of that paragraph, women seem to have more intuition than men. Okay, notice, you know, seem, right? It appears, but not really. Okay, and I was getting at it. It's just, you know, what manifests. You know, we don't have a very profound ability to judge each other about the quality of our superconscious minds, right? We just judge each other based upon what manifests outward, you know, from our conscious minds. But you know, you can see why they seem to have more intuition than men. I was just explaining it, right? I mean, you actually have the spirit of intuition functioning, okay? But now take it a little beyond what I was saying. That isn't intuition. That's just the spirit of intuition. You know, any more than the sixth adjutant is worship. No, it's just the spirit of worship. Worship is a cosmic fact way up on the sixth level of meaning. It's not something that's just innately there on the second level of meaning with the sixth adjutant. Okay? That's not, you know, that's just your religious impulse. That isn't your religious consciousness on the sixth level of meaning. Okay? So, yeah, I mean, you know, you can have this appearance because you have the first adjutant functioning as the spirit of intuition, okay? But that doesn't mean there's a fullness of the three cosmic intuitions manifesting immediately out of a female, you know, more than a man. And then the other one, but they appear to be somewhat less logical. Why do they appear that way? Well, that's because the guy has an initial tendency to focus on his second adjutant and do dot to dot, you know, rational, because it's so directional, right? Ooh, I can go dot to dot to dot. I love directions. I like going dot to dot on a line, okay? You know, and our initial thought about logical, we think it's rational. Okay, it's like, okay, no. Okay, it's much more than that.
It appears like
that. Okay. Genuine logic is very transcendent of merely rational. Okay, but see, that's why it appears, right, that the man is more logical. Okay, yeah, you know, he's just more instinctually rational, but whether it's even reasonable rationalizing is another matter, let alone logical rationalizing.
And a woman, okay, can
think the difference. Yeah. Might look at a situation just as an analogy. Like, you know, when we look at a picture, we take the whole thing in and give the context. And mm-hmm. So if you had to make a decision, you saw the whole picture in context, then you could easily just jump to the solution because you have the full context,
yeah,
at one time.
Right.
You don't go through and look at every little,
yeah,
bit of the picture,
yeah,
and analyze every little dot and tittle.
Right, right.
And then finally conclude, oh, well, this must be this.
Right, right.
You know, like,
right.
You know,
right. Instead of
like a man might kind,
right,
of.
Right, the woman can just have the whole.
Sometimes, not always, but.
Yes, exactly. I mean, the woman, you know, has a more immediate tendency to kind of just grab a hold of the whole circle. But the man has to construct it. Well, there's this line, there's this line, there's this line, there's this line, there's this line. Eventually, you fill out the whole circle, okay?
So we rationalize.
Yeah, John?
Yeah, before you go on, you know, the part that got me the most in this mm-hmm. paragraph was that she's the spiritual leader of mankind.
Right.
You know, which makes me jealous.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly. Because to me, that is probably the highest calling of that you can have. You know, to me, that's much better than being a CEO in a business, or, you know, being a great athlete, or you know, or anything. I mean, like, being a spiritual leader to mankind is like the epitome of what I can see as, you know, of something that would really be something to strive for. Really,
right, but again,
and that's something, if she's that,
yeah,
innately in a way, I guess.
It's, right, but again, put it in context, okay? It's not very profound to begin with. So she's a spiritual leader to begin with, and the man is just using the first adjutant as the energy of instinct. The woman is using the first adjutant as the spirit of intuition, and neither of them are really using any of the other adjutants yet. So spiritual is relative, okay?
But the
main thing that they're bringing out here is, like I said, she inescapably is going to be a spiritual leader in the sense of she sparks the family into existence. See?
I grew up in a matriarchal family, and, you know, who was headed, my mom was definitely the spiritual leader in our family, there's no question about it. So I experienced that part of it.
Right.
And, you know, to me, that's kind of like a very, you know, if I were a woman, that would be a calling that I would really want to, you know,
but again, she's always been the moral standard bearer and the spiritual leader because man has been in the early, has just been in that early phase. Oh. So that all changes when you begin to get into the latter phase. Okay, when
is that what you think is saying here?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, again, because we're just talking about what's natural, you know. But as the more we move into an unnatural mode, men can be just as spiritual. It's not like men are doomed to always be the spiritual follower. But inescapably, like I said, I mean, it starts, you know, the energy of instinct follows the spirit of intuition. But eventually, man can have just as much spirit of intuition as woman, you know, and both of them can have equal spirit of understanding and spirit of courage, and et cetera. Okay? I think Michael is kind of a spiritual leader in the local universe of Nebadon. You know, he isn't, you know, doomed to just follow the creative mother's spirit as a spiritual leader. I think he see again, right? Whatever. Spiritually, right? They're on equal footing. They're equally spiritual leaders.
In the early years of the child, the mother, that was the whole Jewish tradition until age five. She was the leader. And males love their mother naturally, I think, more than they do their father. I thought my mom is God. I thought my father was just, you know, he was a nice guy. But when you get older, you start appreciating your father.
Sure, right. Again, we all understand the basics here. But just, yeah, again, just appreciate, right? That just, men should initially honor women. For no other reason, when they humbly recognize that the woman is the one that's sparking civilization into existence,
yeah.
You know, she's the civilizer to begin with. It doesn't mean she's the civilizer forever, but she's definitely the civilizer to begin with because she has a maternal instinct. Yeah.
Chris, could I make a point with Terry and Jean brought up earlier? I don't think it got completely resolved. Real quick, Terry brought up Gene brought up about, you know, this horizontal thing or womb-like thing with the female, you know. I think Terry is correct in the domain with deity, relations with deity. Woman can be the equal. It goes along with the seems and appears. It's how they manifest.
I didn't say they were equal there.
And I think Gene's correct.
And again,
manifestation when it comes to relations, the manifestation.
The most important thing about all this is we have all kinds of appearances that we think we understand right now, but none of us can even imagine men and women on a normal world in a post-Pistole Sun age. There's nothing in your wildest imagination that can even imagine the behavior of a man or the behavior of a woman in a post-Pistole Sun age. So we all have to avoid getting too into, I think I understand how this all works, and let's just think about that all the way to that light in life.
Right.
I mean, we can't even imagine, okay? So, always keep that in mind.
Yeah, well, it's good to speculate.
Yeah, yeah. But just remember about speculation.
You have time limits.
It's very easy to run away with speculation. You know, remember in paper 102 about speculation.
The differences of nature, reaction, viewpoint, and thinking between men and women, far from occasioning concern, should be regarded as highly beneficial to mankind, both individually and collectively. Many orders of universe creatures are created in dual phases of personality manifestation among mortals, material sons, and mid-seniters. This difference is described as male and female. Among seraphim, cherubim, and Moronta companions, it has been denominated positive or aggressive and negative or retiring. Such dual associations greatly multiply versatility and overcome inherent limitations, even as do certain triune associations in the Paradise Havona system.
Okay, we've already kind of talked about that many times. That's the super additive consequence potential of the differential. But notice how they're fleshing out at the beginning there. The differences of nature, reaction, viewpoint, and thinking. And they purposely are giving you all those. It's not just one issue. Their nature's different. Their reactions are different, their viewpoint is different, and their thinking is different. I'm stressing that because they're going to build upon that here as we continue.
Men and women need each other in their moronchal and spiritual, as well as in their mortal careers. The differences in viewpoint between male and female persist even beyond the first life and throughout the local and super universe ascensions. And even in Havona, the pilgrims who were once men and women will still be aiding each other in the paradise ascent. Never, even in the core of the finality, will the creature metamorphose so far as to obliterate the personality trends that humans call male and female. Always will these two basic variations of humankind continue to intrigue, stimulate, encourage, and assist each other. Always will they be mutually dependent on cooperation in the solution of perplexing universe problems and in the overcoming of manifold cosmic difficulties.
Maybe step one is just notice, wow, heaven doesn't sound like what they always told me. Seems like heaven is about the solution of perplexing universe problems and the overcoming of manifold cosmic difficulties. Okay, that's the first thing to notice there. Right, the problems don't get easier or disappear as you go up. They get bigger and more complicated until they involve all of the grand universe has to be considered, you know, because the problem is so vast.
Now that you've been given much.
Yeah, much is expected of your insight. So there's that. But here's, see, John, I told you it was coming up. And notice here, notice the specifics. Okay, they started out, here as mortals, we have differences of nature, reaction, viewpoint, and thinking. Okay, but here they talked about, you have metamorphosis. You are moving up. We were talking about that. I mean, you're transcending an awful lot of these initial animal origin differentials. I mean, by the time you get to the third mansion world, you've transcended a lot of them, let alone when you become part of the core of finality, okay? So you may leave nature, reaction, and thinking differences behind, but what don't you leave behind? The differences in viewpoint between male and female persist even beyond, okay? Why is that? Why is it that you always, the vantage point that you stand on, when you look out on things and assess it, why is it inescapably different? Because you are your experiences, right? And a man will never be a collection of female experience. And a female will never be a collection of male experience. Right? And you stand upon your experiential acquirement. That's your viewpoint. You cannot view the world around you, even in the core of finality and beyond, from any vantage point except your experiential acquirement. You're never going to be some sort of existential being that stands on that viewpoint, right? No, you're always going to be an experiential being. Right? Like right now, your experiential vantage point demands that the universe appear to be very incomplete. It demands that you, when you look through a telescope out in the outer space levels, the deeper you go, the you know the less there is, and there's nothing out in the third and fourth outer space levels and all that. Okay, well, that's not really what's there. Really, there's a cosmos infinite, and it's all complete. But your viewpoint is that they aren't there, because your viewpoint is an experiential, limited viewpoint, a finite experiential one. If you were an absentite being and you looked out, you'd see something very different right now. Not in the future, right now. That's what they're getting at. That viewpoint is, you know, you can never go off of that. You know, we can be, our thinking will eventually be completely on the same page and everything, you know, and our nature, you know, obviously way transcend our nature and our animal reactions and all that. Okay, you transcend all that. Okay. But, you know, your experiential viewpoint is what it is forever.
So, yay.
You know, and that's why things that happen in your life can affect the entire afterlife.
Yeah.
Okay? In truth. Right? I mean, maybe you're just immediately talking in that sentence about, you know, the rest of your life here on this planet. Okay? But the factual interpretation of the sentence is not the most important thing. The truthful interpretation of the sentence is more important. It's like, in truth, see, right, you're never going to leave your experiences behind. You are your experiences. Yeah.
So in reference to personality trends, that's pretty elevated.
Yeah, there's personality trends, and there's, you notice in that the preceding paragraph you had personality manifestation. Again, there's not male and female personalities. But personalities don't manifest directly. They manifest through a self, an experiential self. And that's male or female. Forevermore, you know, in the viewpoint sense anyway. I mean, you're not going to have a maternal instinct, ladies, on the Isle of Paradise, okay? You're going to leave that nature long behind, okay? But you're not going to leave, you know, that self behind. Yep.
I got a tough question. So my brother was gay.
Uh-huh.
And he told me, he said, John, he said, you know, I'm a woman in a man's body.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is he a woman or is he a man in terms of the perspective that you're talking about?
Again, what he is, he's the experiences he had. I mean, that's, see.
Okay, I just don't know.
See, again, I mean,
it's hard to answer that question.
Right, again, it's not like they're, you know, everyone that becomes a finaliter was a material son or daughter, where male and female is very definitively differentiated. A lot of them are one-time mortals. And mortals have a spectrum, okay? Yeah, we're just talking simplistically here. But the whole point is, you know, whatever your experience is what you are,
okay.
Right? And he will always view reality predicated on that experiential nature. None of us are gay or straight on the Isle of Paradise as finaliters. You know, we leave all that behind, okay? But the core essential experiential nature that those initial sort of eyes accumulated, right, is what you accumulated. And you're never going to, it's like, well, let's swap this out for some other motive. No, I mean, you are only your accumulations. You're no one else's, you know, experiential accumulations.
Yeah. The unique self.
I mean.
Just a unique self.
Yeah. You know, maybe you could say that some men and women, you know, become finaliters a little bit more like when a seraphim becomes a finaliter, you know, and the differential that they started with is more of a positive negative differential, aggressive retiring differential, you know, genuine, gay and lesbian couples are an angel, you know, are seraphim, are angel-like, you know, in that polarity, you know, rather than male-female polarity.
While the sexes never can hope fully to understand each other, they are effectively complementary. And though cooperation is often more or less personally antagonistic, it is capable of maintaining and reproducing society. Marriage is an institution designed to compose sex differences, meanwhile affecting the continuation of civilization and ensuring the reproduction of the race.
The biggie there, and I just want to stress, is marriage is an institution designed to compose sex differences. I got a powerful statement that is. We have all of these sex differences. It's like, how are we going to, marriage is an institution designed to compose sex differences. So if marriage breaks down, what's that going to do in society when all those sex differences are kind of still in the raw? See, they're reminding you that, you know, there's only certain ways that you can compose differences. And there's nothing that has the power of, you know, what brings you and keeps you together in marriage and holding those differences together in intimate association so that each can refine the other. Yeah. See, they're just, what else is going to do it? Not the workplace. That should be obvious. See that. So they're just reminding you of that. When marriage and family starts to break down, you're going to have more and more men and women who out there influencing society without any tempering of their natural, nature, reaction, viewpoint, thinking, etc. You know, it doesn't matter if it's man or woman, right? A woman who hasn't been composed, you know, in this relationship, you know, is just more and more what she is naturally, and that's limited. Same way with man, you know. There's no super additive consequence, you know, embodied within either of them. They're just what they are in the raw. And civilization is doomed to be pretty primitive if that's the case.
Decomposed.
Yeah. So, and you see, they as they end it here, they reemphasize that.
Marriage is the mother of all human institutions, for it leads directly to home founding and home maintenance, which is the structural basis of society. The family is vitally linked to the mechanism of self-maintenance. It is the sole hope of race perpetuation under the mores of civilization, while at the same time it most effectively provides certain highly satisfactory forms of self-gratification. The family is man's greatest purely human achievement, combining, as it does, the evolution of the biologic relations of male and female with the social relations of husband and wife.
See what they do at the end there? What are you naturally? You're a male or you're a female? You put a male and a female together in marriage, and you don't just have a married male and a married female. Eventually, you have something that needs to have a different name. Like, eventually you have to call him a master son instead of a creator son because his nature is different.
And so is hers.
Husband and wife. See, what they're using, they're saying, think about those terms anew. It isn't just a word that indicates that the man and the woman are married. It's deeper than that. It's not just a technical differential. You know, he's not a man anymore. He's a man that has a superadditive additive added to him because he's related to a female in a marriage and has become something that's more than a man, a husband. For lack of a better word, see, they're basically saying there. And the same way for the woman. You know, a wife isn't just a married woman, you know, like a master son is just a creator son who's been hanging around his local universe longer than just a creator son. He's a different being. He's a more civilized being. And that's what they're trying to end with there.
Less crude.
Mm-hmm. And it's in the same way that the woman has the deficits, she doesn't have as many of those deficits now. Just like the man doesn't have as many as his deficits. Right? And you can only get it that way. Remember, they tell you that, you know, you can't get off of Gerasim and head towards Adentia until you've acquired some of that superadditive consequence of the relationship between male and female. It's not just a parental thing. There's two things that you can't get any other way. The only way that you can add to yourself like that is to actually be intimately engaged with that other. Okay? Now, it's super, super late here, so we're going to need to wrap it up. But this is great fun stuff to talk about. Like I always say, please think about it more yourself. I want to just try to highlight, you know, the key things like that to give you something that you maybe hadn't noticed yet. Don't let the limitations of language in the book cut you off from the greater recognition of truth that's there to be had. Okay, let's take a moment, everyone.